Hello, it is the 8th of April, and this is episode 87 of the Crate and Crowbar podcast. I am Tom Francis. With me here today are...
Graham Smith.
And...
Marge Davis.
And...
the other Tom.
Said in a very operatic voice. Mm. And we're all excited, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because the new Deus Ex has been announced. And weirdly, I thought they announced it in dribs and drabs. Like, they sort of... in some ways, killed the excitement of the announcement by teasing it so much, and by... I mean, they sort of announced, like, Deus Ex Universe months and months ago, and that was, like... it didn't seem to mean anything except that just Deus Ex is a franchise now, which it already was.
Yeah.
And then they announced hair technology. Did you see? Like, come and see a talk about how hair will work in the next Deus Ex game, which was like, the next Deus Ex? What are you talking about? Which game? And so it was like, really exciting game that they'll be talking about, but the least exciting aspect of it they could possibly be talking about, so I haven't
I'm pretty excited about that hair business.
What about that pointy beard?
Yeah.
Well, now his beard can flow with Tress Effect, because it's the tech that animated Lara Croft's hair in the last two
years. I think they did the same thing with the Lara Croft reboot, actually. I think they introduced it via a Tress Effect demo at GDC.
Really? Yeah. Some sort of weird NVIDIA deal that exists where people have to announce their games via Tress Effect, the hair technology.
Well, there are, I don't know if this was one, but lots of sessions at GDC are sponsored, like the people talking about their tech are paid to talk about their tech. Mm. But anyway, now they've actually announced it, but then even then they did like a 3-day Twitch stream of a person being just tortured for 3 days, and you got to vote on like how he answered questions while he was being interrogated.
I didn't miss any of that.
And then there was the leak via some Russian
website. Yeah, and then it got leaked by a Russian magazine.
And then Game Informer put up some images with some very brief snippets of the trailer.
Yeah.
And then we got the trailer and the actual announcement.
So I sort of had time to get used to each individual aspect of this as it's come out. And also, the whole thing is, it's what I thought they would do, which is, let's just do more of that game, because it was fucking great, and we got it right, and everyone liked it. And probably fix some mistakes. And so... in that sense, also, it's not a sort of massive megaton, oh my god, I can't believe they're doing this specifically. So, they're doing exactly what we thought they were doing. But
it's, you know, set in Paris, I think, some of it?
Is it?
Well, there seem to be European statues, and there was the Paris appeared on, like, the screen at some point.
Prague's definitely in it, because you zoom in on one of the screens. In fact, one of the characters is revealed to be James something Burke, is his name. Cyber terrorist, and he blows up a Prague train station. I think you see that. That's the explosion you see in the trailer.
Okay. There is, like, he's looking at a screen or something at some point, and it looks like the river that runs through Prague with some buildings, and then, like, a futuristic building that puts, like, almost like a roof over the top of it.
Yeah, like a ecology shard. Yeah.
All things must have two layers now. is what Deus Ex teaches us.
Every piece of architecture has to be social commentary, some kind, about the class system that exists in this world. Yeah.
Or made entirely out of fluorescent tubes.
Yeah. Oh, hanging fluorescent gold tubes are back. They're still in style.
I love that the decorator who does those, obviously, is just like, he's sort of the Christopher Wren of his time, just going around, like, doing a signature style everywhere. Mm. And just carefully adjusting, like, the twine that's hanging them so that, oh, that twine can't be too similar to the other twine length because it needs to hang at this jaunty angle.
Which coincidentally looks like a pair of angel wings when viewed from a particular...
yeah, weirdly.
Device that you use at least once in that trailer. Jepson's very good at standing in front of light beams.
It does feel like, despite that, they've gone a little bit easier on the gold in this in order to sort of intentionally mark it out. But then they haven't really replaced it with anything. It's just sort of a bit greyish.
Mm. Not in a boring way, but just... were quite just dark, and like people wearing dark costumes in front of dark backgrounds.
I think you've got to pick a new colour. I think they should be all red. Or all blue.
I think they played down the roughs a little bit.
The controversy of the day. Eidos Montreal downplaying the roughs in Desert.
You saw a news presenter lady, and she did have a somewhat pronounced collar.
It was the same one, right?
Yeah.
Isaac Kassam. No, wasn't she exposed to be a... Sorry?
Sounds rough.
wasn't she, I mean, spoiler alert for Deus Ex Human Revolution, exposed to be an AI and... wasn't she...
yes. I suppose she was shut down. I think she carried on.
Well, I suppose, have they said anything about how they're going to deal with the endings?
Cause it looks pretty like the ending where you... spoilers, again... this boy with when you choose to flood the whatever plant thing that you're in at the end. That seems to be the canonical ending because you see him being airlifted out of...
yeah, he's floating in water, isn't he, with angel wings behind him.
Yeah.
And he's also saying that he tried to save the world and failed, which I presume was his attempt to... Well,
hopefully they're all attempt to save the world.
Yes.
It's quite interesting, because so Deus Ex 1 had the same kind of ending where you got to choose the fate of the world by switching on various machines. And you have like a choice machine in which you pick whether all technology should be abolished, or whether everyone should be forced to use technology all the time, or whether the Illuminati should run the world. <It's> like, no middle ground. And then Deus Ex 2 sort of said they all kind of happened.
Mm.
Like, JC took over Helios and merged with it and became an all-powerful AI, except that also Area 51 was shut down and global communications underwent some kind of problem, and then the Illuminati is still there as well. So all three things happened, which, I don't know, sort of made the choice retroactively null. And then this one, I don't know, it's trickier. But still, it seems like picking one option, saying Jensen did that, whatever you did, still feels a bit of a transgression of a series entirely about player choice.
I don't care so much about the ending of Human Revolution. The choice that I care about is Malik.
Oh, yeah.
Whose VTOL crashes and you get attacked, and it is possible to save her. And I did a no-kill playthrough where it was really fucking hard to save her without killing any of the people who were trying to...
Did you do Trank 'em all?
Trankom and EMP grenades, I think.
Wow.
Errors and 600 attempts is how you save her.
It's a lot of ketamine going into those soldiers.
And so I would like it if that was recognized and she was in the game, but then presumably if she died and you felt any kind of emotional impact from that, as the game hoped you would in Human Revolution, then you would feel in some way betrayed by the fact that, actually she's still alive, actually it was fine.
Yeah, because I read that they're not importing your save game.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they can't.
Maybe she's
to your choices.
She's an AI. Everybody dies in Deus Ex. It can just be an AI. It's fine.
For stuff like that, I feel like they could just do a, like, Dragon Age Keep thing and just ask you, what did you do? How did it end? That's probably simpler than importing a save. But for the end of the world, it's gonna sort of affect everything, you would think.
I don't really mind that they just breeze over that, because it was such an arbitrary and last-minute choice anyway.
Yeah.
It feels like they're free to pick something canon and just go with it, really. I don't mind.
Is everyone happy to be Jensen again?
Yeah, I like to.
Yeah.
I like Jensen as well.
I was thinking about this, because it's not entirely surprising that they do this. And I was thinking, like, would I rather they start a new character? And then, if they start a new character, they've got to get it at least as right as they did with Jensen. And then the potential to do something more with it is not really increased by that. Whereas if they carry on with Jensen, then he's kind of got a backstory already that we know and that he can build on. And it sounds like there's a kind of redemption angle, and he feels like he fucked up everything in the first game, which is broadly true.
Well, there was something you posted in our chat room earlier, Tom, which I assume is a quote from one of the developers. And it seemed like they were saying that some people enjoyed the stealth parts more in the first game. So now they've made the shooting better. Which seems like a strange takeaway from what should be a stealth game. And the trailer is very, very punchy, shooty, stabby.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's necessarily alarming, because, like, obviously they're going to show their action before they show stealth. Somebody hiding in a vent isn't going to sell the game to people.
The Human Revolution CG trailer was very stabbing. Similar, both in terms of like the visual style of it, the music, and the way it kind of rises to a crescendo at the end, but also, you running around, fist chiseling guys, fighting robot dudes, punching way through walls and that kind of stuff.
It's a very notable ability reveals, I think, for the main game.
You can fire your chisels now.
Yeah. And you can, you've got like knockout taser knuckles.
Yeah, I noticed there was two different, I think there were two different, orcs that seemed like non-lethal things. There was like a taser one, and there was also like one that seemed like a Peps gun type blast.
Yeah.
But from your hand.
There's also like a blink like ability where you seem to teleport, which I don't know how they're going to explain how that really works.
Nano.
Yeah, it's just nano. But it's interesting, they're kind of exceeding the kind of technology level of the first game, to which this is apparently a prequel, I assume.
I mean, to some extent, the Human Revolution did as well. There's a lot of, the orcs are just awesome in that. And Deus Ex, they're not that good. They're like, regenerate 2 health points per second. Or, like, breathe slightly longer underwater.
I just want the Icarus landing system back because it's one of my favourite abilities in any game.
I really want that, but I don't want it to always do the cutscene. Because
love that cutscene.
I don't get it now because it just takes too long to land. I get bored waiting for myself to land.
It's so beautiful, though.
And I want to land silently, and I don't want to be dead. But I'm incredibly patient.
They're all stunned by how beautiful your landing is that they can't help it.
If you do the ground stomp thing, if you don't, then they're just like, yeah, there he is, kill him. Big ball of golden light, that's him.
There's also the turn into low polygon man.
Yeah. Reduce poly count! Conserve memory! That's kind of like, that's the sort of payoff of the whole trailer, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Like, it all builds towards him activating a nano shield and then it just cuts out before you sort of get to see it do anything. And it's like, that's not the coolest ability, really. I mean, maybe if it makes you completely invulnerable for like a few seconds, that's kind of interesting. But if it's just like, I'm tougher for a while, that's like, toughness abilities are the most boring ones because you have to get hit for them to be any use.
Mm-hmm. I like the visual effect of it, though.
Yeah.
I like as the polygon. I like the carrying on the triangle motif. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I follow, I think I've said this before, but I follow the art director, Jean-Jacques Pelletet, on Tumblr, and it's just a litany of photographs from around the web that he's found of things with triangles on them.
Found another triangle, guys!
And like, fluorescent light bulbs and triangle shapes hanging from ceilings and stuff.
It's all based on real life.
Yeah.
I like the little flourishes like that because they can really like define an entire aesthetic for a game or a series. Like Mass Effect, for example, there's a particular arc that recurs through all their armour, and even the logo, the arc of the planet is the arc that persists throughout all their armour design and a lot of their environment design. They're kind of this gentle curves of the Asari, like the Asari's head, the forehead, like it's in every, like, it's constantly recurring. So it's part of the kind of visual language you recognise as being Mass Effectian, if you like. And that's where this stuff comes from. So I guess Deus Ex Human Revolution has its triangles. Deus Ex are triangles now. It's cool.
That's one step up from the previous art style, which was none. I don't know, stuff. Try and make it look a bit like real life, but not all the way.
The shield ability reminded me of David Lynch's Dune film, where shields were a big thing in Dune. And I think it was one of the first ever digital effects to be used in a film, where they would activate these shields and these giant, amazing kind of boxes.
Yeah.
Shiny boxes.
They're like hitboxes, basically.
They were hitboxes, yeah. But there's an amazing mechanic to Dune, fighting in Dune, where the slow blade penetrates the shield.
Yeah.
So it reflects bullets because they're fast, but anything's slow. So there's this amazing martial art that Frank Herbert invented that was about slowly killing people, hiding a very slow strike behind lots of distracting blows.
It's really cool.
So yeah, anyway.
I guess I'm quite optimistic that they will do better boss fights this time, because they, obviously that was the biggest complaint about Human Revolution, or most common complaint anyway, and it was pretty universal. And for anyone who didn't see, they later said that, oh, those were actually farmed out to another developer. Mm-hmm. And sounded like maybe it was a Square Enix kind of mandate that they had to have these boss fights, and maybe Eidos Montreal didn't want to make them or couldn't make them, and so they were farmed out to a different developer, which explains why they feel so different and kind of go against a lot of what the game's about. And then in the shipping container DLC, whose name I can't remember, but it takes place in lots of shipping containers.
Missing Link.
Yes. Lots of people didn't like that. I fucking love that DLC. Partly because I love being inside ships. But that has a boss fight at the end of it that is kind of, it's by Eidos Montreal, and it's kind of how they, it sort of feels like a, almost like a manifesto for here's what the boss fight should be like. Like, sorry about the other ones, here's how we would have done it. And it's really good. It's just a massive, I think it's a room full of shipping containers. And there's the guy you're trying to get to is like the antagonist of the plot. So you know who he is and stuff, and you've been reading logs about him and things. And he's in there in some kind of office at the back, kind of elevated. And there is a hatch in the floor of the office you can get up through. There's a hatch in the ceiling you can get down through. There's a window I think you can probably shoot him through. But he's just surrounded by a really heavily guarded compound. So it's just a really difficult bit of Deus Ex stealthiness or shootiness, if you want to do that way. Or however you've been playing the game. And if you can get to him, then you can take him out in one hit with your fist chisels, or you can do a non-lethal takedown, or you can use whatever else, and it all just works. Which is, you know, the problem with a traditional boss fight is Deus Ex is all about doing these, has loads of different ways of taking people out instantaneously, and if You can't do that at all. If you can do it on a boss, the boss fight's over. And if you can't do it on a boss, then most of your options are just kind of gone.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a really good solution to that. And if they can do that, that would be awesome.
They said in the developer's commentary for the Human Revolution Director's Cut that the boss fight in The Missing Link was just their design for the first boss fight in Human Revolution. Like, that's how all the boss fights were supposed to be, and the actual structure of it is exactly what they designed for the first boss fight in Human Revolution, but then it became clear that they didn't have time in the schedule to do it, and that's when they had to cut it and farm those chunks out to another company who obviously had spare manpower to be able to do it for them.
But I forgot there was a director's commentary I still don't listen to.
It's great. Yeah, it's really good. And I'm like super glad that all those people seem to be back for the new one, because Mary DeMarle is the narrative director again, because I like the writing in Human Revolution.
Yeah. It was really the sort of I guess I liked it all, really, but the main plot wasn't the most interesting part to me. It was more about kind of just the richness of it, and just the fact that everywhere you go, you find not only more info about the main plot, but also ways it ties into Deus Ex, and just loads and loads of that sense of like being in a city hub and just knowing every apartment you break into, there'll be a story for who lives there and what they're doing. And, you know, one of them's like an org dealer, and you find upgrade stuff in his place. And one of them's a black market weapons dealer, and you can only buy the silencer from him. And if you read their emails, you find out what kind of trouble they've got into and stuff like that.
The trailer is very boss fighty. It's got
it is a bit
enormous, pretty stereotypical Russian terrorist type.
Yeah, he doesn't excite me very much.
It's a lot like Barrett, actually, from...
Also, just sounds like every crazy middle European radical who lectures you about his philosophy for a while and then you beat him up. Done that a lot in video games, I feel like.
But there's also the other guy in the hood who seems to be a terrorist as well, and it's kind of contradictory, because in some scenes Jensen's actually defending him from police who are beating him up, but I think he's also hunting him as well, because like the guy kisses the hooded guy kisses the big guy's hand at one point.
Kisses the robo fist.
Kisses the robo fist. Join the cult.
I'm assuming that's setting up like a factional divide. That's hopefully you as Jensen get to navigate and choose which side you're going to help or do missions for.
That's what I really hoped. Seeing that stuff.
Like, already, just even in the first trailer, there's a not-so-different you and I. That's going to come up, I guess.
I'm glad that Jensen's morose,
smoking, drinking, looking for a bar.
At one point, he literally goes...
He was like that at the start of Deus Ex Revolution.
There's one point where he literally goes, "So much pain." Like that.
And then he stabs a guy through the ribcage with a fistula, which is like, that's partly your fault, man.
I love the bit where, like, he's been monologued at by the big dude, and then Jensen's response is just fistula through him through the robot hand. Like, touche. I see your robot fist and raise you a giant fist.
Also, I noticed there's, I really want to know what form this takes, but you can clearly now punch a man through a wall, which makes sense because they're already destructible walls and there's already a punch. But what I want to know is that like a sort of context sensitive thing that happens if you do a non-lethal takedown, or is it an upgrade to like the wall bash takedown, where that wall bash move where you can only do it if you have a guy there? And also, does the guy die? Because realistically, I feel like his chances aren't good.
My favourite thing in the Human Revolution CG trailer is the point where Jensen spots a guy through a wall, runs over to it, punches through it, breaks the guy's neck, and then just turns around and walks away.
Through the wall. I wasn't going that way.
Going that way. It's fine. Just walks off.
The least realistic thing about of all the unrealistic things that happen in the new trailer is that Jensen doesn't have to stop every 5 seconds to eat an energy bar and continue his mass killing spree. So maybe hopefully they've toned that down a little bit.
There's a real disconnect, I think, even more than with the previous trailer for the last game, between what he's saying about how sad he is about all suffering and then what they're showing of just, look at this fucking awesome suffering! Look at that spray of suffering out across the room in slow motion! And I feel like it's probably, I don't think it bodes ill for the game. I think the plot will probably be good, and I don't think it'll be a game about violence and murdering people for to solve world problems. Because Jonathan Blow is saying something to that effect, like, let's solve all the social problems in the world by brutally murdering this one guy. Which is a very valid criticism of a lot of video games, but actually Human Revolution is one of the few where when you get to the final boss fight is just a conversation. You just have to, like, right. figure out what to do and, you know, listen to his side of the story and decide whether you agree with it or not.
Mm. Could they improve those conversation mechanics, do you think?
I really like them as they were. I really like the, particularly like the sort of conversational fights, the ones where you can actually fail them and, cause like, I think the one that always sticks, I mean, the one at the police reception goes on maybe a bit long depending on, which path you take, and it maybe isn't as convincing because you kind of, if you play it right, you just flip this guy completely from hating you into loving you, which feels a bit weird. But Tracer Tong, I thought was, oh, sorry, Tong, was, just really good. He just kicked my ass everywhere. Everything I wanted to say to him, he had a really good reason why that he shouldn't do what I'm asking. I'm like, fuck. I should have to really think about it.
Well, I hope they bring back the orc that, lets you deploy a kind of gas of nanobots that can tell when the other person is hungry or sleepy or whatever.
Psychic nanobot gas engage.
Which is actually really fascinating. It reminded me of the Voight-Kampff test from Blade Runner, because there's little meters appearing all over your vision that set up display. Really, but all the so many abilities in that game are just really satisfying to use.
Yeah,
which is why I hope they don't have chocolate bar mechanic where you have to eat.
Yeah, they could. They need to improve that. What was didn't they change it in something? Maybe in the like iOS game, did they change it so that your first two cells regenerate automatically or something like that?
It's just like you're so awesome and you can do such awesome things. Then, but you only have to do one every 20 minutes.
It's only one awesome thing.
Yeah,
it's an awkward thing too because. You can get around it, and the penalty for doing that is just got to carry a lot of protein bars, and you get like the box pack of protein bars. It's just like, I want to buy like the things that they sell in wholesale to the stores. You get one of those that has loads of protein bars in it. It's like, you just feel a bit like a sort of, you feel like a Holland and Barrett. So your favourite org, Tom, is Icarus.
It's the Icarus landing system. I've written an entire article about why. It's mostly because it looks so beautiful and has an amazing sound effect.
Yeah. What about you guys?
I did that no-kill playthrough, but my favourite org is still probably the one that lets you put two human beings on top of each other and cure them both simultaneously on the floor using your fistulas, kebabbing them.
Yeah, that's hard to beat.
It's just the efficiency of it that's like so cruel.
Was that an org? I suppose it was, wasn't it?
Your ability so you can do double takedowns.
Yeah,
and you pick one guy up, throw him at the other, and then when they're lying on top of each other on the ground, just...
See, I love that, but I love the non-lethal version of that, where you just tap two guys on the shoulder and punch them both out. Because it starts off with you tapping one guy on the shoulder, and you just upgrade it. You tap both guys on the
shoulder. Double tap. I love my favourite dual non-lethal takedown is when you can grab one of them, and so the other one, when he tries to punch you, hits his friend. So good. That's awesome. I think my favorite is actually just cloak, even though like functionally it's very conventional.
It doesn't last long,
but it just looks beautiful. And well, I kind of, not that I like that, but it sometimes gives rise to just really cool tactics of like, I can be invisible, but only between that crate and that crate. And so it becomes quite tactical.
Do you think they're going to be able to get beyond the vent paradigm for stealth games? Because that was like the epitome of it, where you're like, well, I could go in the entrance, or I will find the inevitable vent by going down this alley. I think Dishonored got away from that a bit, but I think it got away from it by using Blink to allow you to kind of navigate the geometry in a more interesting way. I'd like to see Deus Ex do something like that rather than have him just go through vents.
If you have Blink.
Yeah, it's quite possible.
It doesn't look very subtle.
No, I wonder if it would just feel too much like a different game if you gave Jensen suddenly like a brand new movement ability. Because like Dishonored, I just didn't walk anywhere. I was just blink, 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 blink. And in some ways it made it too easy as well. I was just bypassing entire levels by just finding the high ground and then blink, blink, blink over everyone's head.
Wouldn't it have been an amazing twist if at the end of Dishonored you find out that the way Blink works is by replicating you and then killing the original? Oh god, almost dead.
I don't think it would damage the game if you had some more kind of like traversal ability, like being able to climb up walls with your fucking sticky hands or jump slightly further or something.
Like that jump org in Human Revolution, but it was stymied by, as we've just said, the fact that it used power and you were always so low in power. Mm. But you could level up your jump and that would let you get to new areas in order to find different vents. but, yeah.
I think the first two I usually get actually are the jump orc and then the heavy lifting one, so that you can stack a tall thing and then jump on top of a tall thing and then jump even higher off that.
Yeah, getting in the back way of that police station is super useful.
Yeah.
It's the thing I like most want from it is just to make use of the new engine in order to have bigger areas, because the Human Revolution tried to have like city hubs, and Detroit is like two closed streets in a back alley, and then you go to, is it Shanghai or where is it in Asia that you go to?
Yeah, it is Shanghai, isn't it?
It's yeah, it has its own name because it's like a small...
Hengxia. Yeah, that's it. Which is, you know, sort of gives you hints that this is this huge kind of Blade Runner metropolis, and then there's just like a single gate that you can go through between the nightclub sort of region and the poor region, and it just feels really constrained, and there's only ever three people on the streets at the same time.
Weirdly, I kind of have an affection for that strange microcosmic way of looking at environments. Like, I mean, that's just been a hallmark of video games forever, where they try and reduce down an environment to a small set of streets from, like, Kingpin onwards, you know. You've got the slums of whatever city it's in, and it's two alleyways. It's like, this isn't Skid Row, this is just, no, Skid House.
Vampire Bloodlines was great for that as well.
Yeah. Like, I kind of weirdly like that. It feels like they've just concentrated the flavour of this entire thing into one little kind of super tasty nugget.
I don't want it to be open world or anything like that, but it would be nice if the cars were car-sized and moved, and it would be nice if they used some of that good Hitman tech or something to have crowds on the streets. So even if it's still only, you know, a microcosm of the world, make that world feel populated and bustling and busy in a way that Human Revolution sometimes... You're going around these, you know, apartment buildings in Detroit, and the apartment buildings are all kind of dinky and, you know, weirdly low from the outside with two bums sat outside on the ground.
You're massively increasing the amount of data pads they need to write entries for then.
I think I would like, I don't mind the size, but I would like every alleyway to kind of have a distinctive feature, because I did find myself getting lost a lot in Chicago and thinking like, oh yeah, the apartment I need to get to is just around the corner here, and then realizing, oh no, it's not this corner, it's a different corner. And then I think the only way I could navigate eventually was like trying to memorize the various NPCs who were arguing, like, this is the one with the lady with the red jacket.
In the trailer, some very encouraging glimpses of what's basically looks to be concept art for environments in between the action scenes, including one of like enormous Borg-like structures that looks like an enormous cube city, which is really dark, and some shots of like city streets, which look very Blade Runner, and it's kind of, you can see a crack of sky, but it's all just like cables and neon signs and stuff.
Have you guys played Satellite Rain at all?
No, yes. Yeah.
It's really good, but also surprisingly, like, you start playing it, and I think, well, it's in this kind of cyberpunk city space with lots of rain, at night, and the neon rain, and I just kind of started playing it, played through a little bit of the tutorial thinking that it was going to be exactly that kind of thing where it's a few streets. And then you just kind of like start scrolling out. I started scrolling out. I kept on panning. And like, the map's huge! Like, it's a huge city and it feels populous. It's bigger than Bath, but that's not saying much. There's some Quake levels that are bigger than Bath.
That was what was exciting about their Kickstarter pitch, was that it was like Syndicate, but on kind of a... not an open world, but on a scale where your impact would ripple out across the city in a way that...
Their plan is for you to kind of receive missions in ways that feel emergent, so they've just come out of the environment at you by exploring, so you find mission givers and stuff, and they'll give you influence on certain factions, and then open up new areas of the city, or like have you be seen in different ways by different districts and that kind of thing, according to their pitch anyway. It sounds really good.
I mean, Syndicate, their original, kind of did it as well. Like, you would have a mission to go into a particular building and kill some people or whatever, but then you would come out and there would be police showing up because there was gunshots, and then you could kill the policeman and get in the cars and drive off and stuff like that. You know, it was kind of doing similar things.
I remember them saying about Deus Ex that they had intended for you to be able to go into the upper part of Hengxia, and that was like their fourth hub, or third hub. And they just didn't have time to finish it. And that makes me wonder if maybe they'll just finish it now. Because why not? It's all in the same, like...
Yeah. Sounds like the developer's commentary makes it sound like they had shitloads of ideas that they just didn't have time to put in. Because you weren't you supposed to go to Montreal? Yeah. And I think the Singapore chunk was meant to be larger as well. Mm. It was meant to be, you're going to go out into the city rather than just being in the TV station building, which I think all Singapore is in the finished game.
Because I wonder how many of those assets are actually reusable now, though. Mm.
They'll have all that design work, though. Just
yeah, even if they didn't make the assets, they'll have concept art and
have they changed engine?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the Dawn engine, which is that bespoke thing they've made? I think it's Square Enix on it, but I don't know if it's made for this game or just...
definitely a new engine. The screenshots that leaked look very nice, but also quite posed.
I am super excited about this game. It's really easy to take the piss out of the trailer, I know PSX in general, but it's not normally excited by game announcements. I think this is probably the most excited I've been for a game announcement since Skyrim in 2011.
It's been 3 or 4 years. They've been working on it, maybe. No? So, out this year, hopefully.
Really?
Well,
it's at least 2 years since they announced Deus Ex Universe, and certainly this team didn't work on Thief, so I'd hope that they were doing more than just the developer's commentary and the shitty iOS.
It's like, announcing now means that they can escalate to maybe showing some of the actual game at E3. And if you're at that state, then it's not out of the question. But
out by Christmas. That'd be great.
Yeah.
It's also, you want to get it out this year because there's not many other games around and there's a new console generation. So if you, you know, every Xbox One owner is going to buy your game if it looks nice.
What else is out this Christmas? Is it going to be a good Christmas? I mean, there's the Vive out, which is the thing I'm most excited about. So.
Star Wars Battlefront.
What else? I'm excited about that.
I've hardly seen anything of Star Wars Battlefront. I mean, I know they're showing more off in the next month at the Star Wars Celebration thing, but I'm assuming that there's going to be a bunch of announcements at E3.
Yeah.
Because every other game that we know of is like out, well, The Witcher's out in what, like 10 days, and GTA 4's out, and GTA 5, sorry, is out in 6 days, and then after that, it's just like, well, Rainbow Six Siege. To perhaps segue.
Man who can go through walls by, well, sort of not punching them, sadly. You have a sledgehammer in Siege that lets you go through things. We've played some of the alpha. Most of us have. Everyone, all of us but Tom.
I haven't, yeah. I watched someone play the alpha for a little bit. Looked alright.
I think Graham's played the most of it, so I don't know what Graham thinks.
What is it? That's what it is.
It's the first Rainbow Six game in a really long time. What was the last one? Vegas 2?
Yeah.
That was great.
It was fucking great. So was Vegas 1. But Rainbow Six Siege is a competitive multiplayer terrorists versus counter-terrorists kind of thing, set in the Rainbow Six universe with a focus on destructible tech. So as the terrorists, you're holding a hostage, you're holed up in, say, an airplane or a suburban house, which is the two maps that are in the closed alpha, and you can... your trousers are basically full of low walls and wood that you can inexplicably run around putting up wooden barriers over doors that takes you about 6 seconds to put up, or like pulling out giant metal contraptions from somewhere to like put reinforcements on floors and on ceilings. And then as the counter-terrorists, you're trying to breach into those areas, get the hostage and get out, or wipe out the terrorists. And as the counter-terrorists, you have destructive capabilities like wall charges or sledgehammers that you can use to destroy the barricades that the terrorists have built, but also to just generally fuck up the scenery. And bullets go through the scenery as well. So as you're playing, you're firing little holes through walls and trying to spy the enemy and that kind of thing. And it's an interesting mixture of sort of Call of Duty-ish, Counter-Strike-y type, quite fast-paced shooting mechanics, much more so than Rainbow Six of old, certainly. But then, like, strategic elements on top. So obviously it's asymmetric in the setup, much more than Counter-Strike or Call of Duty have ever been. It's there's a brief kind of phase at the start. You don't get the full Rainbow Six, here's a map, draw on it, work out your angles of attack or anything. Teams vote on their starting positions, and then the terrorists have a barricade phase where they can put up their defenses, and the counter-terrorists have a remote control car phase where, because they, They don't know to begin with where the terrorists have set up, where in the house or where in the plane, and so they don't know where the hostage is. But you, for a minute, can drive a remote control car, and everyone has their own remote control car, and they can jump. It's really cute to see everyone driving around, and you can try and find where the terrorists have positioned the hostage, and then that fixes that on your HUD, basically, when the round starts proper, so you know where you're going.
Ah.
And then you've got the ability to destroy the environment, but then you've also got stuff like you can grapple, which is the best thing about Vegas, was like grappling up the sides of buildings and then doing simultaneous breaches into rooms, stuff like that. I haven't managed on any of the public servers to get a simultaneous breach yet, but you can totally grapple up the side of a roof and smash your way in through a window and that kind of thing.
Well, dynamically, or are there particular spots where you can do this?
Windows, so particular spots in that regard, but I'm pretty sure you could breach through a wall and then do it, because you can certainly, the rest of the time, you know, I really like, as the counter-terrorists, the sledgehammer. It's just really satisfying to just slam a wall and have it break open, and you can do that not just on barricades, but just any other wooden wall, and then you can leap in through that wall or drop down through that floor. So I assume that if you were hanging off the side of a building, you could do that at certain spots. There are walls which are reinforced or they're metallic. Certainly on the plane level, you can't smash every surface of the plane or anything, only the wooden surfaces. But
The thing I watched was Ian Hickton from Eurogamer playing, and around he played. Everyone, it was on counter-terrorists, and everyone ran up to the side of the building, and they all grappled up to, like, different points on the roof. So it seemed like you could grapple anywhere on the roof and just all climb up. And he did that, and then he let go of his rope and fell to his death. And then someone else had to abort their assault to climb back down and revive him. And then he just got wiped out. And then after he was revived, he was climbing back up the rope and then got to the window, and there's just a terrorist there who just, like, blew his face off.
At the moment, the game has enforced voice comms turned on, so everybody's mics are on. So I imagine, were there any words softly spoken to him?
It's interesting because he was narrating the thing for the viewers. Like, he was sort of saying, "Oh, so in the game you do this and this and this," and then saying, "Oh, I think we're all going to wrap it up here," and then yada yada. So presumably everyone could hear him saying that. Just a bit like, "Shut up, Ian."
I've only played the plane level, so I guess there aren't really many opportunities to grapple there.
But how does that work in terms of, like, the house seemed like the counter-terrorists had a lot of freedom in terms of where they chose to approach from. But on a plane, I imagine there's only so many options, right?
Well, there's quite a few entrances along the side of a giant jumbo jet.
Four entrances from the outside of the plane, and then there's...
Wait, how does this work? Is the plane in flight?
No.
That'd be a bit.
That's what was throwing me.
Four entrances from the outside, and then it's at least two stories as well. I think maybe even three stories, and so you also can pick what floor you're going to move on and then burst through the floor, which is really fun. Playing it on public servers so far, certainly in alpha, where there is no lobby functionality or party functionality, so it's pretty impossible to play it with friends or people you know. Certainly suggests that this is a game that's going to shine when you play it with a clan, or at the very least people you know. Like, I know you were saying that you were joining servers with people speaking in languages you didn't understand.
I couldn't even recognise some of them. It's quite exciting.
On the servers I was playing on, just no one was talking. It was just silence. Like, I've been told this was a game all about voice comms by someone who'd played it just before me, and I was expecting that, so I plugged in my microphone, and then just no one said anything. The only time anyone spoke was me, when I saw a guy lying on the floor, crawling away injured, panicked because I thought he was an enemy, and threw a grenade down. And then as I realised, just went, sorry, and he just looked up at me and stared. And then the grenade went off and he died.
Still wordless even to the last. Yeah.
The defenders have, like, you were telling me this because I was confused as to how, because when you die you watch a kill cam of the person killing you. And so I dialed and died in this hail of bullets. I was like, but I was in a cupboard, like, pretty much. And cut to this guy's kill cam. And he's got his face up against this wall texture. And he kind of bounces up a bit. Then he moves to the right, looks at a painting, shoots the painting, and then I die. So he must have known that I was some 20 feet on the other side of that painting, on the other side of several other rooms. And I didn't realise quite how this happened, but you were saying that there's a particular gadget for that.
Yeah, someone can hold down middle mouse button to bring up like a lens, and it gives you like heat signatures through walls. And because you can see your own, you know, friendly player tags, you always know that an untagged heat signature is going to be an enemy. And in this game, where pretty much most surfaces are destructible, you shoot bullets through, you might as well just like plow a load of bullets through it in that general direction and hopefully get lucky. I think like maybe one of the weaknesses is that there's a lot of spray and pray that happens that is perhaps too effective as a tactic, where if you hear the noise coming from a vague direction, you could just go, you know, Scarface in that direction and probably get some hits and knock them down.
Yeah.
Because bullets are so deadly and they don't seem to become less deadly if they've gone through a wall.
Mm.
So maybe if it wounded or took health off in some way, if it had penetrated some surfaces, you know, I don't know. I don't know how you'd solve it, but it feels like I've been shot by just totally lucky random sprays. And especially because there are like, it's very choke pointy on the plane level, particularly. Mm.
You must know where, like, there's four entrances to the plane. And I'm sure pro players or people who play it a lot are just going to know when they spawn in a particular room, which angle they need to be looking at to fill that particular entry with bullets. You know, even if it's like, you know, 50 meters away or something like that, they just aim up into a light fitting and unload a clip. And you've got, you know, five people on your team, four of you pick an entrance each and just kill people through the floor and walls. But I guess that gadget does mean that you definitely need voice comms, because otherwise you can't communicate to the rest of your team vital information about where everybody is.
There seems to be loads of there's one player that can control little mini drones that can stun people, but also it's just a great recon tool that's obviously designed to have you fly around and call enemies. And I don't understand how the game can function in pub servers if everyone involved doesn't have a certain amount of expertise and happens to be communicative and happens to speak the same language. I mean, it seems like there are so many variables that require it to be fun as a pub game. But that doesn't mean it can't be amazing as a team game you play with your mates.
Yeah, I think the one thing, I mean, I was saying in chat to you earlier that Counter-Strike already has this, it's not a problem, but when you see really good Counter-Strike players, they know just to throw a flashbang over a building at this angle, because there's a likelihood that people will be in that point of the map on the other side. And that seemed, and Siege seems to exaggerate that thing quite a lot, because so much of the map is just available to your gunfire from the beginning, because bullets pass through stuff. But I wonder if the flip side to that is whether the environment is just so destructible that you're actually not limited by those checkpoints. It seems that that's not the case on the plane level, but it sounds like it is on the house level.
I much prefer the house level to the plane level.
Right.
I've had some good bits on the plane level where there's kind of like a loft, an attic to the plane. I don't know what kind of plane is really. Maybe luxury planes have this. But you can sneak up there and you can just plant an explosive charge on the floor and just like cave in the roof right over the hostage, and that feels fucking amazing. That's really satisfying. There's clearly loads of potential for just kind of badass moves like that, especially if you're playing together. And as Graham says, you coordinate and then just go in really silently, because you can just like crouch and move quietly. And sound is really important in that game, it seems, already, just on the hour I've played of it. Where just like, if you hear a sledgehammer going through a wall, it just tells you everything you need to know, like, immediately, you know there's this corridor you've got to cover. So.
It does seem like a game that's designed, though, for, it's going to have a kind of meta game, it's going to be continually balanced, it's going to be people sharing tips on Reddit, because there are, well, I had one experience on the house level where I was in the hallway in the house and I got shot from miles away, and it's because if you spawn as a terrorist on the construction site, there's like half-built buildings, and if you go onto the roofs of those half-built buildings with a particular gun, you can see like 60 foot through a window into the house.
Right.
So obviously a game designed for, you're going to be learning these angles of attack, and if one of them becomes overpowered, they'll have to balance it to change it. But it's also, it's because it's asymmetric, it's hard to get a sense of how balanced it is between the two sides, because, like, traditionally, if you're the terrorist on, say, like, militia or assault, which are two Counter-Strike levels where the terrorists are kind of bunkered in and can cover their areas of attack, they have they're kind of imbalanced maps, because as the counter-terrorists, you're outside these buildings getting funneled through particular choke points. And so far, it doesn't really feel like that to me in Siege. It feels much more like the terrorists have a disadvantage, because all that happens is you barricade up all the doors, and now you're trapped. Now there's just four of you trapped in a very small space.
Yeah.
And the counter-terrorists, although you've barricaded up all those doors, they can still come through any one of those doors or blow a hole in those two walls, or that ceiling, or that ceiling, or come through that cupboard, or come through the floor here. And so you just feel like, huh, we've just trapped ourselves in a very small, insecure room, where if they blow one of these doors and throw a grenade in, then, you know, it feels like as terrorists, you're going to need to learn particular strategies and where everyone needs to be and what angles you're going to need to cover. And it's going to they're going to discover that there's one room in the house, for example, which is just much easier to defend than any of the other rooms in the house. And then it just becomes about that.
It's like Left 4 Dead became just about hiding in the closet, because that's the best place to take on the tank. If all four of you are in the closet and you all just fire out all at once, then that takes care of the tank better than almost any other strategy when it first came out, at least.
Mm-hmm. So you get to expert, and then the best thing you can do in Left 4 Dead 2 anyway is melee. Melee is the most efficient way to kill an expert tank in Left 4 Dead. There are loads of like hidden pro strats in Left 4 Dead 2 that are just really counterintuitive, but until you actually get to that level. Siege, like, it feels like a game that would actually benefit loads from early access, having that kind of iterative, responsive. You're hearing all these, letting the community discover how your maps are broken. especially because, like, the maps are so destructible that I don't understand how you could design them, and know, all the exploits. But it's not really Ubisoft style, is it?
No, I can't imagine them doing that.
They're doing an alpha, so it's a step in that direction.
Mm. I did have fun with it. I've only played it for like an hour and a half, but, although I spent half that time not knowing where I should be going and not feeling like I was... It's hard with these kinds of games when you first start playing them to feel useful and necessary to your team. Sometimes you just think, oh, I know, I'll barricade these two doors and then I'll wait in this corner. And you wait in that corner for like 50 seconds and then the round's over because your teammates have gone and killed all the enemies. And you're like, okay. But it's got enough satisfying ideas. I like the fact that you can shoot the walls. It's nice to put up barricades. The sledgehammer does feel great. It feels super powerful, as you said, Tom, to blow holes through floors. A bunch of the other classes are quite nice to play with as well. I like you can put down barbed wire to slow down enemies. You can put down gas grenades. You can put down, remote mines, that sort of stuff. Reminds me in some ways of playing, GoldenEye multiplayer on the N64. There was a particular level in that, which I can't remember what it was called, but it was set over two levels with lots of ramps and some rooms which were... Some rooms that you could only get in through one entrance, but then they would have a window at the back that you could throw grenades in, and then you could play that multiplayer with like a mutator to make it just remote mines only.
Oh yeah.
And so I remember playing shitloads of that. And in a weird way, Rainbow Six Siege feels the same way, of just hunkering down in rooms and setting up traps for other players and trying to second guess each other.
I like it. I want to play more of it, but I want to play more of it with people.
It'd be funny if one round you're hiding in your like perfect camping spot as a terrorist, and then the wall is smashed down by Adam Jensen, who just grabs and rings your neck and just walks out. No interest in the hostage.
What have you been playing, Tom?
I've been playing... actually, it is another game where you can bash the wall and grab somebody. I haven't been doing that in it, but it's also another game where you can kill two people at once, or get two people to... defeat two people at once. Batman Arkham City, which I've been playing. That's kind of... It's been my, like, stress relief game for years, but I haven't played it in quite a while because I must have uninstalled it at some point, and now I think I discovered I owned the Game of the Year edition, which has all the DLC bundled with it, and so I downloaded that and played it again, but either I've lost my saves or they're incompatible with the Game of the Year edition, so I have no save games. But all I want to play is the challenge modes, because there's the thing I love about it is the combat. The stealth stuff, I remember enjoying it in the single player game, but not so much that I want to play the challenge rooms for it. I think I did back when it came out, but they're not the kind of things I want to go back to again and again. But the just fighting a massive mob of enemies is amazingly satisfying and cool, even just in the base game as Batman. But Catwoman is the thing the character I love to play as, because she just controls completely differently and has her own personality to it. I think I've talked about it on the podcast before, maybe closer to the time. But yeah, finally installed it again to do that. Unfortunately, the challenge rooms are only unlocked by your progress in single player, and it had none of my saves. So the only thing I could play was the Nightwing DLC comes with a bunch of challenge rooms, and those are unlocked by default because you bought them, so they don't want to lock them off. And so those are the only ones available to me, and they're almost all like weird special case ones. Like there's one where it's the Penguin has you in like a ring, and there's just infinite enemies. They just keep on pouring in, which is fun in some ways, but then they keep pouring in like, taser enemies, which are really hard to deal with, and shield enemies, which are really hard to deal with. And the way like Batman's combat works is like the core of it is so incredibly simple. It's just, goons surround you. You can press attack and you'll almost always hit one, particularly if you're pressing towards somebody and you'll dash quite a long way to get them. And the longer your combo is, the more people you hit, the further you'll go to do that. So once you've got more than like 5 hits, you literally just hit anybody in the entire room, no matter how far they're away they are. Just, as long as you're pushing towards the right guy and you press attack, you will just do cartwheels and somersaults and just flip all the way over there and hit them. And the only reason to break that pattern is if people are attacking you, and then you get a little like flashy thing over their head saying they're going to attack you, and then you've got to press the counter button to not only avoid all damage from the attack, but also attack them back. And that also counts as to your combo score. And that's basically the core of it, and that's just doing that actually is relatively tricky once it gets up to like the larger numbers of enemies. But you get the hang of it eventually. And so the game itself just throws pattern break after pattern break at you. So the first thing is like knife guys who attack you, and technically their attacks can be countered, but you have to counter them 3 times in a row with precise timing whilst holding backwards. And then at the last slash, you can optionally hold forwards to actually counter them and defeat them. But it's such a fucking hassle, and it goes wrong so often that you just learn to just run away. They just swipe at you, just do something else. And that I can just about cope with. But then there's also the taser guys, where if you attack them from anywhere within like a sort of 70 to 90 degree angle from their facing, you will take damage and you won't hurt them. And the damage itself, in general, like taking damage isn't that big a deal, but the fact that you've taken damage means you lose your combo, and the combos go on for things like the last good one I got was like 92 hits, and if you just hit 92 people consecutively and then someone tasers you, it's like, for fuck's sake!
This is your stress relief game.
Yeah. It's an incredibly stressful game. But it's very much, it's the only like really intensely skill-based game, or at least it feels more skill-based than, say, Spelunky. Spelunky's the other like really hardcore game I play a lot. But I feel like Spelunky, you just kind of learn how to deal with each individual enemy. I guess it's kind of the same in that way. But, I don't know, it feels much more like a challenge-based game. It feels much more like a fighting game, because it is one. And it's the only fighting game I like. It's the only game where it feels like it's basically just all skill, and I actually get pleasure from mastering it. And when I fuck up like that, it is frustrating, but it's almost always the good kind of frustration. It's like, I know I can do better. I know why that happened. I know how to change it next time. And when there are moments of like bad frustration where you feel like it's unfair, usually a few rounds later, I think, actually, I know how to deal with that now. Like at first I thought, if you see the counter thing, that means pressing counter will always counter them no matter how far away they are. And that's true to a large extent. You could be really far away from them. You can, particularly as Catwoman, because she's much faster than Batman, you can see someone about to attack you, the counter thing can appear. You can go off and hit someone else, and then after you've beat them up, press the counter button and still zap back to the person who's still doing the first attack and then perfectly counter it and do this beautiful animation. And that's really satisfying and really cool. But if they're like 3 inches further away than the absolute limit, then even though the icon's still displaying, it won't do it. And so that feels like bullshit at first, but then eventually you learn like, actually, it's probably fair enough. He's like 50 meters away. He did that attack like 10 seconds ago. Maybe I shouldn't be able to counter it. And so yeah, I've just been learning that, and the challenge room that I keep doing, there's only one in that DLC pack that I'm allowed to do. Of all the challenge rooms I'm allowed to do, there's only one that I actually like, because it doesn't have too many of those pattern breakers, because once you get past the taser guys, there's also the shield guys, and then there's the massive one-armed lieutenants who have like a scythe thing, and loads of the most fundamental rules of the game go out the window then, because usually if you're doing like a special move, like a combo, once you build a combo, you can do like a finisher. And when you're doing that, everyone just backs off. Like, you're going to take one of those guys and you're going to break his arm. And all of his friends are just like, whoa, let her do this. Wait this out, guys. And that's like a universal rule. Like, it's not only will they not initiate any attacks, but if they're already attacking when it happens, their attacks will go through you. You're literally completely invulnerable. Unless there's a guy with one arm, and if there's a guy with one arm, he can hit you while you're doing that. And so that's another thing where, like, it's just one pattern break too far, and I don't want to have to think about that at the same time. I want to feel like when I do a finisher, it's like a time to rotate the camera a bit and figure out what my next move is and who I'm going
to reflect.
Time to reflect. While Catwoman is, like, twisting someone to the ground with both her legs and then twisting his arm behind his back so that she can snap it, it's a time to take stock of your lot in life and think about your next move. But yeah, so I've been playing that one room for like, I had quite a lot of stressful things to do on heat signature lately, so I've been playing this game a lot, and I've just been playing that one room again and again and again, and I finally got to the point where I basically kind of mastered it. I've got the best, like, sort of the gold score plus 50%, so clearly doing well at it, and then I was looking at a guide, and I was thinking like, I remember there being more moves in this, and I was sticking to just a few moves intentionally, because it's all about just mastering the particular timing of those things. I don't want to make it more complicated than I had to. But then I was reading a guide that talked about Catwoman being able to do this, like, multi-whip thing, and I sort of vaguely remember doing it, but the key combination they said just didn't work. And I looked up loads of different guides, and it's, like, getting really frustrating, because they all say the same thing, but it just doesn't work. And then I remembered, actually, you unlock moves. Like, when you progress through the campaign, I didn't really think about it, because by the time you go to the challenge rooms, you've already played most of the game, so everything's unlocked pretty much. But yeah, like, most of your moves are actually unlocked by progress through the campaign. And so I downloaded someone else's save, because I can't find mine. They're scattered all over my hard drive, none of them work, and I think some of them might be lost forever. One of them's under my Xbox Live account name, which is, I guess, because it used to be Games for Windows Live game.
Oh yeah, it was.
Way back in the day. So that's probably why I lost my saves, actually. It's probably because it was Games for Windows Live last time I played. But yeah, so
Was worth it.
Yeah, on balance, that's a good thing. But so I got someone else to save and I installed it and it works. And they've completed enough of the story that all of these challenge rooms are unlocked, so I can go back and play like loads of different ones now. But it has the weirdly unsettling thing that this guy who did all that has a bunch of scores already on this. I mean, I've lost my great scores on that one challenge room, but that didn't matter because I immediately beat it. And he hadn't played any of those DLC ones. They're all blank and pristine, so I get all my own scores on those. But then the main challenge rooms, he's played a bunch, and so he's got high scores on them, and they're not my high scores, and it feels really, really wrong. It was like sleeping in someone else's bed or something. It's like, this isn't mine, why is it all there? And so now I've had to go through and try and beat his score on every single one, so that at least it's my score there.
Is he better at it than you are?
Luckily, no. He probably is in general, but I think he always plays as Batman, because his Catwoman scores are just not very good.
It sounds great.
Yeah, it's really, I think the combat system in that is just a masterpiece of engineering and animation, and it's just stunningly beautiful to watch. It's just like, if I was a filmmaker and I wanted to choreograph some fights, I think I'd just play Batman a bit and then trace over it. Just do exactly what happened just then, because look at it, it's fucking incredible.
Well, good news, Arkham Knight seems to have not really done much to change the combat system.
Ah, good.
But it looks like
I haven't even played whatever the other one was, Arkham Origins, I didn't hear anything. Yeah, no one said anything positive about the combat. Like, no one said it was better. Some people said it was worse, and that was it.
Mm.
So yeah, I don't really want to play a worse version of this.
The abilities they put in that give you shortcuts that you always take that make the combat boring, like electric fists, where you just activate them, power them by clicking with both sticks, and then you just punch anyone any time, and it's fine. And like, as you say, all that skill game is lost at the moment you do that.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But hopefully Arkham Knight won't.
No, it's back in Rocksteady's hands, so like, they're the guys who came up with that system.
Now you can use the car as part of your combat manoeuvres.
Yeah.
Radioing it in to have it run over people for you and seamlessly flipping in and out of it even while it's moving.
It doesn't have Catwoman though, right? As far as we are.
Yeah. I don't know.
No, maybe it's like, she could just turn up. Could be DLC, I suppose.
Mm.
Who knows?
Yeah, Nightwing and Robin, I think, are both DLC.
Yeah. One has two small sticks or something. One has big, one big stick.
Yeah.
It's all about the sticks.
Robin's really good, actually. Nightwing's, like, it's hard to play as him because he looks like such a douche. Robin is really good though because he's just, yeah, it's just a stick and it really makes the stick noises when you hit someone with it. It's really just cracking a stick against someone's skull. He also has like, that in itself seems like it'd probably kill most people who attacks with it, but also the special weapon is like remote detonated bombs that he plants literally on people. Like, you do a special move and you plant a bomb on them and then later on you detonate it and it has massive radius effect and it can hit like 25 people, but it doesn't kill anyone.
Of course not.
It's a non-lethal explosive.
I played Arkham Knight at an event and there are kind of contextual kind of, they're not finishes because you supposedly like kill the person. However, you do ram them into an electrical socket and they're disabling them that way, or up into a light fitting. Like smash them like vertically up into a light fitting using your Batman strength. It's deeply satisfying. It's really good. Really good. Looks beautiful as well.
All that lovely suffering.
So much
as Jensen would say.
Yes. They should get together. They'd have a lot to cry about over drinks.
So tell me about those fist chisels. Should we do questions?
From questions? Where else, Graham?
Yeah.
Where else?
Okay. Ben Monroe writes, "Evening, gents. I've never been one for the Dark Souls series. Ooh. Marty, get him. I've always enjoyed listening and watching the many torturous playthroughs that brave souls such as yourselves have embarked upon. But I've never been brave enough to take the plunge myself. However, I've got to admit that the overwhelmingly positive praise that Bloodborne has been receiving has finally pushed me over the edge, and I think I'm ready to drag myself kicking and screaming through a Bloodborne/Dark Souls game. However, the question is, where do I start? So I turn to your well-educated opinions on the Souls series. I am fortunate enough to game both on the PS4 and PC, and with the new DX11 version of Dark Souls 2 available on Steam for half the price of Bloodborne, do you think I'd be better off playing through Dark Souls 2 or skipping the Souls series entirely and starting with Bloodborne? Cheers, guys. Love the show and really appreciate your thoughts. Ben from Cardiff in Wales."
It's tricky, considering it's quite expensive to buy a new game full price. I don't know, and Dark Souls 2 is the easiest out of all of those games, but it is the worst game, but it's also probably more enjoyable to play if you're not well-versed in the series, I'd say.
I think if you've watched a load of videos, you'll already be familiar with the kind of hurdles you're going to have to overcome.
Yeah.
And you might be ready to do Dark Souls.
Dark Souls 1.
Dark Souls 1. But you could also play Bloodborne, which is, I think, like, Bloodborne's easier in a lot of ways. I think it's, like, combat is more intuitive. Like, it's more similar to other fighting systems than Dark Souls, which is very methodical in a way that will seem alien to someone who's coming to it first time. I also think there's value in joining in with something that everyone is talking about and excited about, especially in a game like Bloodborne where, like, the wiki is still half full. Like, people are still finding things out about that game and trying to piece the lore together. And if you want to be a part of that, then that's really exciting. And doesn't come around that often, really. The kind of game that's big enough and mysterious enough to create that kind of community discussion. And being part of that might be worth the price, potentially.
Yeah.
It's also great.
Is it a better game than Dark Souls 1?
Oh, gosh, it's too early to say.
No, I don't know yet, really. But it's certainly probably a better game than Dark Souls 2.
And also, I kind of cancel against the First Sin updated release of Dark Souls 2, because it reshuffled a lot of the enemy placement. But enemy placement's a really important part of the story in Dark Souls games, and in like these in From Software games. Where enemies are tells you a lot about the environment, and the stuff you find on them tells you a lot about the place they're in, and lets you kind of piece together the narrative. So if you're just mixing all that stuff up, you know, it's something that's fun if you've played through Dark Souls 2 already. However, I think if you're coming to a cold, I'm not sure it's that good to go through a remixed version of, you know, environments where enemies that probably shouldn't be there are there. Think about that as well.
Sounds like two votes for Bloodborne.
Bloodborne it is. Dave Allen writes, "Guys and positive diversity proving occasional gal. Hi." Been watching some of Tom and Graham's Far Cry 4 videos over breakfast, and it inspired me to email in with some questions. First off, the obligatory praise. Effing fantastic podcast, guys. It's not obligatory, we just appreciate it. Initially, I felt they were too long, and you spoke too quickly for my Canadian ears. All right, fuck you, buddy. However, I quickly grew to appreciate your work, specifically the fact you don't just talk about games, you talk about design, about cultural impact and effects, you talk about feelings, choices, and you can, on occasion, you can even be funny.
Oh my god. Brutal faint praise.
So moving on to the questions. On very rare occasions, a game has made me so scared that I have actually got vertigo. You know the feeling you get when you look over the top of a skyscraper, that tingling in your feet and balls when you realise that all you have to do is lean a little more and you're finished. What game experience have given your body's mental or psychological reactions to primeval fears? I already know about, I think, Tom's fear of whales and overhead shadows. I'll give you an example. Frontier Elite 2, leaving Ross 154. I accidentally hit the time fast-forward button instead of hyperspace, and in a split second it took me to realise and press the correct button to go back to normal time, I was a gnat's cock from the cast giant. The cast giant was filling up my entire 14-inch cathode ray monitor, which was massive, and I could feel my ship getting caught in the gravity well. I really felt I was so dangerously close to this gas giant that I was about to be torn apart. My feet tingled so much I thought half my capillaries were going to burst. Awesome. Keep up the amazing work, and thanks for reigniting my love of games and directing me which ones to go for.
It's weird, because a gas giant seemed to be quite soft. But that's a cool story. It made me think of Mirror's Edge. That was the one where I just had a really, like, instinctive and primal terror of the drops. Like, the first time you fall off a building in Mirror's Edge, it really feels like, oh, shit! It really gets you. It's funny, because the fall of buildings a lot in my life, but particularly in my gaming life, and it doesn't... I would say, like, most of the time, it has no real impact or effect. Like, there are loads of games where I'll just throw myself off a ledge to see what happens and things like that. But the games where it does have an effect, I mean, actually, one of the others is Battlefield 2. I remember having loads of moments where, like, jumping out of a jet or something and thinking, yeah, I can do this. And then as you actually jump out, you think, oh my god, what have I done? And both of those games are by DICE.
I used to get it a lot in Quake Engine games, like the feeling of, I'm sure it has something to do with the momentum, the speed at which you speed up and when you're falling, like, say, halfway from great heights. That coupled with jumping puzzles where you're trying very hard not to fall and then suddenly you fall and you go...
And it's that moment where there's nothing you can do. Like, it's beyond saving.
And you get that kind of... there's a kind of rush in the head, which I think is that kind of vertical feeling that you're talking about.
Never get into third-person games.
No. Seems like the Vive is just a device for creating these experiences.
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember if I talked about this when I did talk about the Vive, but there was one demo where the area in which I was allowed to walk in, well, in which I physically could walk in real life, was bigger than the area in which I could safely walk in the game, i.e. as on a platform that's smaller than the sort of play area. And so I could step off it if I liked, but I couldn't make myself do it like I intended to. I'm like, okay, I'm going to step off and see what that feels like. And I just, my foot just wouldn't do it. No, I'm going to stay on the platform. And so that's definitely going to do that for people.
I think it was Chet Fauzek that told the story of one of the, this wasn't at GDC or anything, but one of their earlier prototypes, maybe it was at Valve Dev Days last year, was stepping off a cliff where you actually would fall by stepping forward. Oh, and just like, most people just wouldn't, couldn't do it, you know, knowing that they would fall and having that effect. It's just not, no. Going to do that.
Reckless disregard for gravity, has Oculus Rift support, which I tried once, and I would not recommend it. It's extremely effective in what it intends to do, but it's deeply unsettling.
I found that game to not have a great sense of falling when I played it, which sort of spoiled it for me, because it's entirely about that.
Yeah.
I guess because presumably you're not accelerating as fast as you would be in that situation in real life, because the whole game is going to be falling, right? So,
yeah, also I think it's because you are falling in empty space. Like, you create, get a sense of speed from context, from I was close to you, rushing past you, And there's, like, often there's not enough of that if you're not, like, going down a tunnel or something. That's why probably the rules are that you have to get close to things to pick up points.
Yeah.
Like, that you kiss buildings and things, don't you?
Yeah.
As you go down.
Weirdly, one of the games with the worst falling I've played is Just Cause 2, which is otherwise one of my favourite games, but you fall so slowly in it. They obviously were really concerned that you should always have time to activate your parachute and grapple and stuff, and they didn't want you to die from falling. And so you just fall at a snail's pace, and it just ruins the danger of it. It just makes, you jump out of the vehicle and you're just saying, yeah, I've got ages, it doesn't matter. I'm not even like, you know, even when you do hit the ground, it doesn't feel convincing that you even would die from it, because like, from that height you would die, but at that speed, you could probably just walk off.
I think in that game you can grapple and pull yourself to the ground.
Yeah, yeah.
And the grappling to pull yourself to the ground is faster than your fall speed. So even if you've jumped from a plane, you can just...
and causes you no damage.
Yeah. It was the, I think you played it, the Just Cause 2 mod that just makes you fly,
the
but
Superman,
it's just the
one,
kind of falling animation. Like you're like 6 feet off the ground and you can just hover.
That's the logical extreme of that. I would just like follow around like inches behind someone's head, just hovering in full Superman pose, going, hello, what are you doing?
That's what people would do if Superman was real. Mr. Higgins writes, hello gents. When I have a chance to create my own character, I will definitely create a female character, which some find strange. It often seems that when men create female characters, it's to create some sort of over-sexualized fantasy. I prefer to create a realistic female that would more or less fit into the game I am creating it for. I have played tons of games that have a male hero, and I'm totally fine with that, but it's great to be able to play as a capable female when I get the chance. Do you guys prefer male or female characters when you get a chance to choose? Do you create characters, male or female, that are realistic or fantasy? Does it depend on the game you are playing? I continually enjoy the podcast. Keep them coming. Oh, would you consider a video podcast every now and again? Mr. Higgins.
I used to always play as a kind of, recreation of myself to some extent in games. Recently, in the last year, I don't know what this says, maybe some kind of hormonal change in my body as I reach middle age, but I've started playing as female characters in games. And I wonder if, well, not exclusively, but just like, it doesn't seem to be the same sort of choice anymore. And I think it's partly because female characters have become more interesting to play, then there's more opportunity to play female characters now. But also, I wonder if it's partly because I kind of... in a game like Mass Effect or something where there is a different voice actor, and perhaps in other RPGs, there are different, and also actually in Mass Effect as well, there are different choices you can make based on your gender. Like, I think if I play a female character, I'm getting something, an experience which I wouldn't necessarily be able to predict, whereas I can extrapolate from that experience what the male character's experience would be like, but I don't know if that's possible the other way around.
Yeah.
I always wondered if it's focus testing where male characters in games are just smoothed down to the dullest nub, basically. And they tend to be either just boring or outright objectionable bro dudes. You know, their haircuts alone offend me. Whereas with women characters, that doesn't seem to be entirely the case. I don't know whether that's that they're not focus grouped so vigorously, or just that the focus groups that they're given to don't have such strong opinions about the women characters, or maybe it's just that women are allowed in the minds of men to be more emotional and interesting in a way that, you know, if they see another guy express a feeling, they object to in some way. Mm.
There was a depressing thing that Valve said about testing Left 4 Dead, where the characters will kind of bark things at you as you play, and they found that if Zoe ever said anything kind of like nagging to you, even if it was just like reload or something like that, people would get really pissed off at her really quickly and report that they didn't like that character and really pissed off at her. Whereas Bill, the old man, can just literally, personally, deeply insult you, and they're all like, oh, he's such a character, he's such a good old Bill, we love him. And people are, I guess male gamers have really low tolerance for being jibed at by female characters.
Shut up, Mum!
Yes. I always play as a female character when I possibly can, for many reasons. One is that it's almost always a more interesting story for it to be a woman in that role, because you're almost always playing the most important person in the universe. And so in Mass Effect, it's awesome, and just way more interesting if the person who you know, is admitted into the Spectres as the first human representative of this secret agency is a female, major in the Alliance Navy. I don't know what your rank is when you start, but you're, like, reasonably high up. Actually, you must be less than captain, right? Because you're answering to a captain. But then, like, Saints Row, it's automatically more interesting if the leader of this gang that ends up taking the world and then becomes president of the world and then saves it from aliens is a woman. And just in every case, there's always a less overdone story. It's always something you just haven't heard this story that often. It's usually a man in this role. And so that automatically makes it more interesting. And, yeah, I usually find something offensive or irritating about the male version.
I was somewhat annoyed with Saints Row 4 where they didn't bring back the same woman who'd done the Hispanic voice in the previous two games.
Oh, right.
So my lady Hispanic character from Saints Row 3, I couldn't carry forward or recreate because it was different voice actresses.
Yeah, that sucks.
But that game's especially great because the voice that you choose dictates the script as well.
Yeah, I didn't realize this.
Completely separate jokes if you're playing the Irish male character versus one of the other male characters.
I'm playing as I think it might even be the default voice, but it's the same one I played in Saints Row 3, and I really like her. She sounds a lot like female Shepard, actually. But she's just a lot more of a jerk. Like, the thing I like about Shepard is she's always, sounds kind of like a little bit world weary. Like, she's just been through a lot of shit in the military, and she's kind of like, doesn't take any shit for anyone, and, she can be straightforward and serious, and she can be kind, but it's always with a slight, like, rasp in her voice of just like, alright, let's get on with this. And then I guess it's like female voice one in Saints Row is the one I play as. Sounds like that, but is just a sort of crazy belligerent jerk and is also like, she sounds quite like a little bit more posh than Shepard and, just has this really interesting, quite acerbic personality, which again is really rare for female characters in games.
Henry writes, hallo, Kirsten und Brechtangen. You may have noticed I'm from Germany. Last year I made a trip to the Computerspiel Museum, in Berlin. There I had the pleasure to use the Pain Station, a two-player arcade game based on Pong, which punishes the losing player with physical pain via heat, electric shocks, and a small whip. I was losing against my opponent and screaming like a little girl from pain, but also because the game was much more exciting and enjoyable this way. I would love to hear your thoughts about this. This also made me think about punishment in games. Naturally. Usually, when you suck at a single-player game, you're punished in one of two ways. One, when you avoid bonus objectives, you miss out on helpful extra tools, so the game gets harder. Two, when you die or lose the game in any way, you have to repeat parts you already finished. So basically, whenever you're bad at a game, it rewards you with either frustration or boredom, which is weird considering a game should provide nothing but pleasure. I know I'm simplifying things here, but I would like to hear what you fine gentlemen think about the best way of player punishment. Thank you very much, Henry. I vote that the best way of player punishment is not a small whip.
Yeah. How is that? What are the logistics of that? Is there like a little boxing glove that comes out with like a whip on it that hits you?
I think I've seen a photo of this.
Heard of it. I feel like, I was wondering if someone told us about it in questions before, like years and years ago. I feel like at least one of us should say, so much pain after that.
Yeah, I think so. This issue has been on my mind a lot recently because I've been playing Bloodborne, obviously. I'm a Dark Souls fan. And those games are not only punishing, but they're literally about punishment. I mean, the characters in Dark Souls are cursed, and that is a thematic element that is very much brought to life by the way in which you play that game.
Cursed by loading screens.
Well, in Bloodborne, yeah. And I think and that's a game about being in a dream state, and so I think there's a kind of, so I think the thing they're going for is like a nightmare where like a Sisyphean task that you encounter in nightmares, where you're shouting at people and they can't hear you, or you know, you're chasing after something and never quite catching it. And that's kind of what Bloodborne feels like when you're playing over and over again. And I think its punishment there is indeed boredom. And I think they've thought hard about how to make death meaningful. And that's their entire purpose. Both the Dark Souls games and Bloodborne are, Dark Souls particularly is thematically about the nature of death and what that means. And you couldn't sell that as part of the fiction unless it was mechanically impactful as well. And I don't know though that the mechanical impact of death being something you fear, is analogous to the fear of boredom. Like, I think fear plays upon you in lots of different ways, and the fear of the, you know, being dead or pain is very different from the fear of having to redo a section of a game. I don't think those two things really match up. And so I don't know that the experiment is entirely successful, and there's certainly parts of Bloodborne which I think, you know, I've got the idea. Really, I don't need to run through a really trivial section again and look at a loading screen, in order to get to the part which I find engaging and challenging. Because at that point, your punishment is to say, I'm no longer a game. It's like your punishment is to become a non-thinking, non-interactive, just time sink. I don't know that that's the ideal solution. Although I appreciate those games' wholehearted commitment and lack of compromise in pursuing
that
idea.
I think it works in Dark Souls and in my experience Bloodborne as well, because all that frustration is cashed in when you make it past the point that you've been throwing yourself at for so long. So when you finally beat that boss, like the exhilaration that I feel when I get past a point and I finally move into a new area, it's just extraordinary because there's been this enormous weight of investment of time behind actually cracking it. And also because when I die, very importantly, like it's very rarely because the game has just fucked me. It's often because I've fucked something up. Like, my skill hasn't been up to the task. And I'm happy to be punished along those lines. Like, if I failed, then I'm happy to be punished for it. And I think.
Yeah, I don't mind the nature of, it's the nature of punishment that I think is the problematic part of that. Like, wouldn't it be better if there was some other means of punishing you other than making you look at loading screens, making you do very, really trivial things again and again and again?
I think the loading screens in that game, like, let's not, we'll cover this in the Bloodborne podcast we do eventually, are a massive unintentional punishment. Like, I think it does lengthen the amount of, like, most of the time in Bloodborne, there's a way to rush to the boss in 30 seconds. There's a way to just run to it. And if not for those loading screens, like it would be like it would balance that punishment reward thing so much better. I think that is genuinely a big problem for the game. Mm. It does generally make it far more frustrating than it needs to be.
What about in any game where you repeat a section?
Most of the time, it is just annoying. Mm. But unless it's a combat game where combat's intrinsically interesting, I don't mind repeating interesting combat. So if I had to go back through Arkham Knights, like Arkham City's combat sections a few times, then I'd enjoy it because I enjoy the combat. Like, the interaction there is just more interesting.
Yeah. I think it's a rare game that where the combat is so good that you actually want to replay, like, the same fight, and Arkham City, I think, is definitely one.
Mm.
But in most games, even amongst games that I like, once I finish a thing, I don't want to do it again. I want to move on to the next thing. And repeating that stuff, I've always hated it, and in recent years, I've developed an almost zero tolerance penalty for it. Like, if I'm playing, like, a game that has been recommended to me or something, and I die in it, and it sets me back further than I would like to be set back, I just stop playing the game forever. It's just completely gone. Doesn't get a second chance. Mm. Don't care what anyone else ever says about it. I'm just not playing that game. I just don't want to waste my life. Just, I want to spend all of my life on things that I actually enjoy and like.
It's a pretty good test for, like, how good, like, the moment-to-moment interactions with the game are, like, the amount to which you can stand that. So, for example, Tom, you had a terrible save game problem with Far Cry 4, but that actually didn't stop you from going back into it, because like, the game was obviously so good that, you know, you were prepared to push through it.
And I knew after that point it was going to become this totally new thing, where once it's out in the open world and doing those outposts, I don't even mind if I lose progress, because I lose, like, it's one of those rare games where if I complete an outpost and then the game crashed or something and I lost that progress and I had to do the outpost again and be like, great. That was awesome.
Yeah, the promise of Dark Souls, for example, is like the opportunity to explore a new place is a huge draw. Like, exploration is so much fun, so interesting. Like the reward is actually just getting into a new place, a new mode of play from this kind of grind that you've been doing.
Once or twice.
Okay.
I think about like how failure works in like these challenge rooms of Arkham City that I've been playing is you do, like, in theory there's a risk of death, and a couple of times I have died in these challenge rooms by just, I've really misunderstood something, or I've just like, those knife guys who like swipe three times and you've got to dodge all three perfectly, I usually fuck up on the first one, and then, because I fucked up and my combo is broken and the flow is over and the whole thing is like gone to shit, I just kind of stand there and let them stab me. Or I'm so frustrated that I repeatedly try and attack them, which I know won't work. And every time I attack them, you get stabbed again. So I just get stabbed like all three times. And then if that happens like more than twice, you're dead. And
see, that should have been the finale to the Batman Nolan series.
Like, oh, that was just too frustrating.
Fine, whatever.
God damn it. But every time I die in that, I'm like, it hasn't happened that much, but just the first couple of times it did, I was just like, oh, that's weird. It's over. Like, I'm not even allowed to carry on. Because until that point, the idea of dying was just completely out of my mind. It was purely about these combos, and I'm just making these combos, and like I say, it goes like, it's quite common to get a combo of like 50 or more, and can go up to hundreds. And so when you've got a combo of 50 and someone interrupts it, is it relevant whether they did damage to you or not? It's irrelevant whether you're close to death or far from death. I don't care about any of that stuff. And you could take out death completely from that without changing anything about how I feel about the moment-to-moment experience and how scared I am of losing that combo. And it's all about just, I've built up this thing, this success, this chain of things that the game is telling me, you did that right, that was awesome, that was cool. And then when that gets broken, that's automatically terrifying and irritating and easily punishment enough. And that's, I think those are the punishment systems I like, is things where it's just, you lose the things you've gained since you started playing, but when you restart, it's not about trying to, you're not redoing things. You still stand to gain those same things, but it's up to you how you do it. And in a way where it is a lot like Spelunky in that sense, because Spelunky, when you die, technically you have to redo all the levels you've done before, but the levels themselves are totally different. And technically, you lose all those things that you had, and that is the part that's frustrating. If you have a jetpack and a shotgun and you die, you're like, ah! And technically, you know, those jetpack and shotgun are probably in the next world you play, and so you could, if you hadn't played the game, you might say, well, isn't that just like you've got to go back and get those same things again? But because the levels themselves are different, it doesn't feel repetitive, and the fact that you getting them again doesn't feel like the same challenge at all. It feels like a totally new thing.
What do you think of that? The idea of mild physical pain as punishment in games.
I mean, I can't imagine myself putting up with that. But in theory, from like a game design point of view, it's like,
it's coming, isn't it? There's going to be haptic feedback along with the Vive, and obviously they're going to think about ways in which.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Vive can probably. I mean, a lot of the ways you signal like failure and punishment to the player already are kind of trying to slightly, not hurt you, but sort of like the jam on your face in Call of Duty is meant to be kind of an offense. It's meant to be like, get it off. And there are lots of things like that where, you know, a character grabs you or something gets really in your face and it's meant to kind of almost hurt. And I think with the Vive, where you're completely immersed and you genuinely believe in all the things that are happening to you, they'll have no trouble inflicting pain.
Yeah,
just psychological pain.
Red Orchestra in the Vive. That'd be horrible. You'd probably actually manifest a horrible wound. Just an experience.
Like a stigmata. Yeah. oh my goodness. PC Owners Phil Savage played a load of CCP's prototypes. They're kind of experimental virtual reality prototypes.
Right.
And some of the punishment, they talked to the designers, and some of the punishment mechanisms they used was to intentionally induce the nausea that you get.
Oh no!
And this is particularly in Eve Valkyrie. So the idea that, you know, you get shot out of control and then you die of this instant respawn, but they punish you by giving you that nausea in the way that you're shot. They're experimenting with this idea that they can actually give you this physical sensation of it and punish you physically by disorientating your senses.
Wearing a, you know, VR system.
Really interesting. It's just there are just gives you so many more ways to fuck with people and punish.
Don't need that tiny whip anymore.
I just don't think that interests me at all. Like when I get, you know, you get that like the vest you can wear so that when you get shot in a game, you actually get like a feeling of like electric pain where the bullet would have hit you on the chest. But when I play a first person shooter, I'm not thinking of it in most of the time in terms of I'm being shot with a man with a gun and he's got bullets and bullets kill people and I'm worried about dying. I'm thinking about it much more abstractly of this is a problem of geometry and geography of like he's that angle from me, there is this obstacle in between us, I need to position myself in this such a way as to change the angle so I could shoot him without him shooting me. Like, I'm thinking about it on those terms. That's the kind of challenge. It's a spatial and a positional challenge that I'm thinking of.
But then,
so I don't want to manifest the bullets in a greater form because they're not bullets. They're just, it is just a line of sight thing from him to me.
Wouldn't it give you that embodiment though, if it gives you that physical pain that would then, you know, help you contextualise it in a way that actually is
more... I just think that would enrich the experience, though, because that's not the fun of it. The fun of it isn't, hey, I'm killing this guy with bullets, and he might kill me with bullets, and isn't that fearful? The fun, like, there is fun just purely in that, in its abstracted form, which is why it's still fun. You know, it's almost most fun when it's the difference between a railgun, which travels distances instantly, and a rocket launcher, where the rockets move slowly, and then that, because that introduces a different positional challenge because you've got to account for the time that the rockets are going to take to get there and that sort of stuff. Like, that's the kind of thing I'm interested in first-person shooters, not manifesting the splash damage in a way that makes my legs sore.
Yeah, so I definitely don't want games to physically torture me, but I think it's interesting.
Old stance from Tom there.
I just think it's interesting to consider the possibilities.
Yeah, it's certainly interesting.
I mean, the 360 controller, like, feebly attempts to do this by vibrating somewhat.
Yeah, yeah.
Ah, the terror, the horror of war. Can't you feel it in your hands? You've been shot.
I love force feedback, actually.
I really hate the vibration thing. I always turn it off. It's always an option, which is nice. And I find it just so sad and miserable and irritating. It's like a little child kind of like prodding you like, oh, you were just killing this thing. Look, it's supposed to hurt. And it's like, it's so far from the experience that it wants to emulate that it's pathetic, but also because it's physical, it's irritating. Like, it's actually, you can't completely ignore it.
I think like good force feedback is like, gives you, like, it's great in driving games where it gives you real texture of the road. Like, you know, the way it creates a rhythm actually creates a, like, when you go onto grass, it feels like, really feels different.
Yeah, I wish it was used more like that, because they also do that with the haptic feedback touchpad things on the VR controllers, and presumably on the Steam controller as well. But with 360 controllers, I don't play many driving games, but in other genres, it's very rare for them to do anything with it other than vibrate it to the maximum amount for like 3 seconds to say, ah, thing is happening!
I love it in Tomb Raider when you're kind of like a huge stone lock is kind of on, like, peeling apart in front of you and you feel this like rumbling in your...
Oh, yeah.
And like that to me gives me a real sense that the whole place is kind of underfoot, just shaking.
Mm.
It can be used really, really well.
I think it's good for things that would shake you and bad for things that have shot you in the guts.
Yeah, I suppose so.
And that's all the time for questions we've got.
You can send us questions at questions@crateandcrowbar.com. You can tweet at us. We are @crateandcrowbar on Twitter. And you can post questions on our forum at crateandcrowbar.com/forum, and you can follow us on Twitter individually. I'm @pentadact, PENTADACT.
I am @gonas, GONNAS.
I'm @PCGLudo, LUDO.
I'm @MarshDavis, that's DAVIES.
Thanks for listening.